I was born into a working class family in 1958. We lived on the edge of London in a three-bedroom house. When I was 18 months old, I was diagnosed with cancer of the eyes. And so my eyes were removed, leaving me, of course, totally blind. This changed my life and my family's outlook forever. My parents became confirmed atheists, and basically that's sort of had a bearing, especially with my mother, who said before she died to me that if there was a God, when she met him, she'd have something to say to him. If you knew my mother, he might have been a bit frightened. The education of blind children in the 1960s and 1970s meant that you went to a school full of blind, which would necessarily be a boarding school. At 3.5 years old, I was sent off to Northwood School for the Blind. I was only away from home in the week, but I do recall that this felt like a big wrench. In all the next 2.5 years, I can still remember lying in bed in the dormitory and hearing in the far distance the sound of a revving motorbike or car, and thinking, the person in that car on that motorbike can go where they will. There was the excitement of going home on the Friday afternoon, but all too soon it would be Sunday afternoon, and the apprehension of returning to school on Sunday evening. I can't say life at the Sunshine Home was bad. Everyone made a great effort to give you as good a life as possible, and I met some incredibly kind-hearted people there. But it wasn't good. When I was 6, I took my next step in the world of blind education and was moved to Dalton House School, just outside Sevenoaks in Kent. Dalton dealt with the education of blind children from the home counties from the age of 6 to 18, and there were about 120 of us across the age range. Dalton was a large old manor house set in extensive grounds. It had everything: woods, fields, a rose garden, lily pond, ancient trees, including an enormous oak on the main front lawn, a large sweeping drive, and a flight of steps leading up to an enormous front door. Inside was a large main hall with, at one end, a huge main staircase of shallow stairs with a glass dome above. There was a labyrinth of cellars, numerous rooms accessed through long corridors. For a young child, it was just unbelievable. And the years from 1965 to my leaving in 1970 were the most idyllic years of my life. Of course, there were bad times. Some of the old maid staff could be quite cruel, and it was a cold place in winter. But the good completely outweighed the bad, and I was very happy there. I learned to read and write in Braille at the same age as you were learning to read and write. And my education followed a similar path to that of most of you here, except there were no blackboards, lots of Braille, and lots of listening. I don't recall us being told that we had to learn to make the best use of our remaining senses, but I expect we were. I do recall that we were always being told to keep our heads up. It does appear that if you can't see, your eyes have nothing to focus on, your head drops. We were also taught, when speaking with somebody, to look in their direction. In 1970, I passed my 11 plus and was sent to the only grammar school for blind boys in the country, which was Worcester College for the Blind. Here was a completely different regime. There was an uneasy, not on edge, atmosphere about the place, similar to the feeling which I would associate with a prison or perhaps an army barracks. There was a hardness to the place. My mother described the accommodation as Spartan. There was little time for sentimentality here. And while families were by no means actually discouraged from visiting, I always had the perception that families were kept at arm's length. Between school holidays, I might see my parents only once, and some pupils only saw their parents at holiday time. Without ever really realizing it, I was growing further and further away from my family. In those days, the education of blind children had something of a Christian basis, C of E style. a nursery school, we had to say our prayers each night. At Dorton, there was assembly every morning and a service on Sunday. And at Worcester, which had its own chapel, there was an assembly every day with hymn, reading and prayers and a service on a Sunday. If you volunteered to do the readings for the week, you were allowed to choose your own reading for Saturday, and we pushed the barriers. There were also Christian friends at Worcester who would invite us to their houses for Sunday tea. The upside was the fantastic tea. The downside was the price, which was generally a visit to the Ely Church for the Sunday evening service. Towards the end of the service, the pastor would invite anybody who wanted to come to Jesus to raise their hand. This part of the service seemed to go on forever. And I remember thinking, for goodness sake, will somebody raise a hand? At Worcester, we had also had to take our scripture, O-Level, which was based on our knowledge of two books from the New Testament. I think in our year it was Mark and Acts. I got my O-Level, but I didn't get it, if you get what I mean. Mm. At both Dorton and Worcester, we played a number of sports, including cricket with a football that had ball bearings, little ball bearings, or lead shot in it. So did practical. Of course, we played football itself. We had an indoor pool so we could swim every day, and a running track and rowing. It was at Worcester where I first got my taste for bell walking, as they organised trips to the Black Mountains, Brecon Beacons, and Snowdonia. At Worcester, we also had mobility lessons. This consisted of learning how to use the long cane correctly for finding our way around town. The final test was to take a bus to Birmingham and then come back to Worcester by train. These days, there is much more mobility technology for blind people, from smart canes to Google glasses to apps for smartphones, which will tell you exactly where you are. Plus, in Wychcombe, there is an Alan and a John.
Yeah, well, and John then.
Of course, there are other aids these days. Wobbly bits on pavements to indicate crossing points. Chris McCausland, the blind comedian, convinced another comedian that the wobbly bits were actually Braille. In towns and cities where there are push-button crossings these days, there is often no bleep for when to cross. How does a blind person know when to cross? If you press the button and then run your hand down and under the bottom of the unit, you will find a little plastic cone which starts revolving when it is safe to cross. Not a lot of people know that. In 1976, the next really big changes occurred in my life. In the space of 2 months, I had my first real girlfriend. I turned 18 and my father died. Suddenly, I was my own man. I was no longer concerned about running with the crowd. I was more than happy to hold an opposing opinion, flout the rules, and generally, this was the beginning of my lack of respect for authority. By the time I left school, I had already decided that I would continue my education far enough away from home to have no interference from my family, and that I would shy away from the blind network and blind society. I kept just two friends from school, and after a further 5 years, they too had gone. There is this ridiculous notion of many people that a blind person should want to stick with other blind people, and in the case of a male, he'll find a nice blind girl and settle down. What nonsense. In my generation, there were many more blind boys than blind girls. And in any case, how could blind people ever integrate themselves into normal society by spending their time with other blind people? I had incredibly strong belief in myself. I've never woken up in the morning and thought, I am different. It is only when I get out and about that I then may meet with the full gamut of reactions to blindness, from fright and flight to patronising remarks, to be treated as if I was an ordinary person. Having missed getting to Exeter University by a couple of points, I went to Bristol Polytechnic to study law. On our first day, we were told that none of us would get a first, as the universities would not allow it, and they had the final say. I was quite happy with my finishing up with a Desmond. Especially as by the third year, I was bored with the law and was threatened with being thrown off the course for lack of attendance. I enjoyed the Bristol nightlife and gained a passion for all things horses, which I have to this day. For the third year of the degree, I had to write a thesis on something which was not directly to do with the law. With the help of my tutor, I decided to write about the special unit at Barlinnie Prison in Glasgow. This unit housed prisoners who were serving life sentences and had proved to be violent and disruptive, as they had nothing to lose. One prisoner, Jimmy Boyle, had managed to get a book he had written called A Sense of Freedom, smuggled out of the unit and published. Other than that, the press articles were contradictory, and the government department responsible, the Home and Health Department, was slow to respond to my questions. I decided to go up to Edinburgh on spec to speak to somebody in the department face to face. The civil servant concerned was incredulous when he received a call from reception to say that a blind student from Bristol had come to see him to learn about the special unit. However, with his help, I gained an entry into the unit the following day. When I got back, my tutor couldn't believe it. But I was young, bold, and confident, and had to have no doubts that I would get the material I required. During my 3 years at Polytechnic, I received regular visits from the Christian Union, but their message didn't grab me. I did make friends with one of the Christian students, and so occasionally was invited to a church service or some other meeting. But it all seemed to be a bit twee, a bit middle class, and respect seemed to be based on your earning capacity. I do recall a dreary morning on a rundown part of the Gloucester Road in Bristol. My Christian friend declared that as a Christian, he believed he could live without money. His dad was a hotelier in Jersey. The following week was his son's 21st birthday, and his dad sent him a brand new VW as his present. I subsequently remarked that I believed I could live without money with parents like that. At the end of my degree, I knew that the law was not for me, so with the help of a careers advisor, I decided to try my hand at computer programming. I went on a TOPS course for blind people wanting to learn programming. I passed and got my first job as a trainee programmer at Reading DHSS Computer Centre in 1981. In those days, we had 24-hour turnaround, which meant... which meant you submitted running instructions for your program to the operators and they would run the job overnight. The results would be on your desk next morning for you to check and make corrections ready for the following night's run. I had an adapted typewriter and a print scanner to do my job. At that time, quite a lot of blind people worked in computing. So as computer technology developed, so did the technology for blind people. By the end of my 4.25-year stay in Reading, I had a dumb terminal with a braille display alongside an ordinary keyboard. I had learned to touch type at school. I hated Reading myself. It was a violent place, and I was twice threatened with violence at night on the main street. For the first 3 years, I rented a flat in the slum area of town, partly because it was cheap and partly because it was near the middle of town. At one stage, it appeared that the flat above was rented by a prostitute and the flat below by a guy on drugs. But turnover was fast. The landlord was not averse to turning up late at night to evict people for non-payment of rent or other misdemeanors. I was young and saw the goings-on as part of the rich tapestry of life. Mm-hmm. I also caught a burglar who had broken into my kitchen. I retrieved what he had stolen so far and threw him out. I was quite strong in those days and had caught him by surprise by quickly putting my hand around the door and switching off the light. After 3 years, I moved to a much more upmarket part of town. Even in the workplace, there was a carelessness about others. One colleague did not turn up for a week, and there was little attempt to find out what on earth was going on. After a week, I told my boss that I would find the guy, and I did. He was very, very depressed, but I convinced him he had to come into work and get some help, and he did that. At the end of 1985, I moved on and worked in Huntingdon for Angry and Water, bought my first house in Peterborough. I longed to get back to Bristol, and in 1987 landed a job at CGV. But things really didn't work out, and by 1989 I was again looking for a change of employment. To a great extent, computer staff recruitment was controlled by employment agencies specialising in computer staff. I found these agencies discriminatory, and indeed, I never got a job through one. Computer people advertised the Sunlines were looking for experienced computer programmers. I visited computer people, put my case, handed over my CV, etc. After a week, I was told by computer people that my application had not been successful. I smelt a rat. At that time, there was a very small charity-based organisation that would help disabled people get jobs. Basically, it was a one-man band, a fairly senior figure seconded from a major company to oil the wheels to get disabled people into work. In my case, it was a chap from Unilever. I told him my story, and he got me an interview with Sun Alliance. I worked there as a programmer and then a senior programmer for the next 14 years. I had made it into the private sector. My opinion was respected, and I was being paid well. I was working with a group of people with a similar outlook to myself, and the phrase, "we worked hard and played hard," is not misused here. I had decided that Sun Alliance was where I would spend the rest of my career, and I set in train a financial plan which would allow me to retire at 55. What could possibly go wrong? Meanwhile, I still was looking for a partner. She really had to be the right girl, and it is the greatest sadness to me that I was never able to find the right person. My money kept increasing, and I bought I bought an ideal garden flat in Redland, which also came with a large garden, of which I was the sole owner. This was my latest party venue. These were my decadent days. I remember one girl saying, "I really like Pete, he's always up for anything." In contrast, I went to Quakers meeting for a year. But apart from the elders, I found the Society of Friends not very friendly. For 7 years, I ran the Sun Alliance Bristol Wine Appreciation Society. With a small committee, I arranged wine tastings around about every 6 weeks and organised various companies to come and present their wines. This went so well that we became the second most successful society under the umbrella of the Sun Alliance Social Club. And after 3 years, we had a foreign trip to our event. The Adventure Sports was the top-rated one. I met a chap who invited me to join his horse racing syndicate. There were six of us, and for the next few years, we bought and also bred race horses. However, at the new millennium, my fortunes changed. In 1999, I went to New Zealand, had the holiday of a lifetime, where I went sorbing, bungee jumping, whitewater rafting, as many things as I could possibly fit into a month. It was the holiday of lifetime, but as the new millennium dawned, first of all, our best horse, Rio's King, was badly injured in a race at Newcastle and had to be put down. Another of our horses broke a leg in the gallops and was put down. On my flat, Pittsburgh, I felt cursed. In October 2002, it was announced that RSA, which was what Sunlight had now become, would be closing their Bristol operation and that we would all gradually be made redundant. In June 2003, I exited RSA's Phoenix House for the final time. I was not downhearted. I had a business idea that I was working on. And also, with my years of experience in computing, I thought I would get another job. I stunned everybody by announcing that I would be moving to Cheltenham. Bristol is a great place for the young, but I was growing older and wanted a quieter life. Against the advice of my friends, I moved to Cheltenham in 2004. I was working away on my idea and living very quietly. At one point, I went 6 weeks speaking only to delivery men and occasionally to somebody on the phone. It really didn't bother me. I enjoyed the peace and quiet. One of the people I had worked with, Atara say, was a woman who had graduated from Oxford with a theology degree. We would sometimes go to the pub and discuss or joke about English literary characters. However, she would throw in characters from the Bible, some of which I had not heard, never heard of. I had promised myself that if I ever had the time, I would read the Bible from cover to cover. This was that time. One day at 3 o'clock in the morning, as I was reading, I suddenly had the realization that I had screwed up my life. The vast amount of what I had done in my life had been all about me. Immediately, I did nothing. But I could not get away from what had been revealed to me. There was suddenly a longing to find a church, and it wouldn't go away. Eventually, a Christmas card arrived from Holy Apostles Church, detailing the services, and I decided to go into the carol service. If you have been brought up in a Christian family, you can have no idea of the courage it takes for a non-Christian adult to walk into a church for the first time. On the way to the service, I met two people on their way to the church, and they offered to take me in with them. After the service, I was encouraged to sign up for the next Alpha course, beginning in the January. Alpha didn't really grab me, as a lot of it was Nicky Gumbel videos, and I just didn't take to the man. However, following this, the church as a whole read Rick Warren's book, The Purpose-Driven Life, which was just the job. I was baptized and confirmed later that year. Following Jesus has made me, generally speaking, a lot calmer and a more reflective person. I started reading Christian books from authors such as Philip Yancey, Adrian Plass, and even Nicky Gumbel. Also Christian autobiographies and biographies. A lot of this, these books were supplied by the Torch Trust, the Blind Witch, transcribes Christian works into Braille and does the audio versions. In church, I was on the reading rota, prayer rota, helping organize a home group, and anything else I could think of, including doing a stint on the PCC. In 2006, I had to abandon my business ideas. I just wasn't making any money. I was then unable to get a job. When the recession hit in 2008 and the government scheme for getting disabled people into work failed me, it was decided that I should be placed on incapacity benefit, where I languished until reassessed in 2017. I had moved from being comfortably well off to struggling to make ends meet in a few short years. At times, the financial pressures seemed almost overwhelming. and I was more than well aware of the tenuous thread by which I was hanging on to my financial existence. Occasionally, I pondered over how things had ever come to this. However, generally speaking, it was my friends and my faith that carried me through. The Lord provided my needs, not my wants, my needs. In 2011, I had a serious disagreement with the vicar concerning the use of the church and left. I left because I couldn't allow personal grievances to distract me from my worship. Nevertheless, leaving Holy Apostles was like breaking up with a girlfriend. I went to St. Matthew's, but for the next 2 years, I simply attended the Sunday service. It suddenly dawned on me how I was drifting along. I joined the reading rota, and most importantly, the music group. In 2014, I tried my hand at becoming a listener in sort of Samaritan's capacity. I went on a taster course and then a foundation course with the listening post, and all appeared to be going well when I had a total mental block. You had to write a journal every week, and about 10 weeks into the course, my brain froze. I have still never gone back to look at the notes I made at that time. In 2016, my mother died, leaving me some money, and when I turned 60, my company pension started paying out. I returned to Holy Apostles, and shortly after, volunteers were asked for to take part in Open the Book. In case you don't know, Open the Book is for children between the ages of 5 and 11. It is an exciting storytelling project where Bible stories are shared with children in a way that is fun, interactive, and memorable, using a storybook Bible written by Bob Hartman. In my time as a Christian, this has been one of the most rewarding projects that I have ever been involved with. COVID put an end to going into school and the end of my time at Holy Apostles, as the church did not reopen for 2 months after restrictions were lifted, which I thought unpardonable. But this did give me a chance to visit other churches, and I ended my days in Cheltenham at St. Luke's. 2.5 years ago, I was in Winchcombe, for some reason or other, with a friend, when I suddenly said, "This is where I want to move to." Everybody I knew was opposed to the idea in the beginning, but I simply felt that this was where I was supposed to be. I had never prayed for anything material, but now I prayed for a place in Winchcombe. Although it took 18 months in all to get here, with many a setback along the way, I felt that it would happen in the end. The executors of the place I now live in waited for me to find another buyer when my buyer dropped out. I had been here 3 months when there was a knock at the door. It was the brother of the woman who had lived there, and he wanted to know if I had settled in okay. He told me that his son had been one of the executors. I asked him to thank his son for his patience when my buyers dropped out. He said, "It was meant to be." Thank you.
Thank you, Peter. That was a really detailed moving story.
Sorry, didn't go too long.
No. It's not too long. Could have gone longer,
Peter. Didn't time it.
Does anybody want to ask Peter anything while we're here?
Peter's Martin. Just want to. Do you have any recollection of sight?
None at all.
Really, not at all. Like it.
Sure. I had perfect sight beforehand. We know that. Because my parents used to drop things on the floor just to see if everything was okay when they started thinking things worked. So, I did have, but no, I don't think.
Peter, Richard, just an amazing story. Particularly in the way you've overcome so many difficulties and things. But how did you end up then at Encounter?
Before I think it must be, when did I start looking in I think it was 2021, started looking. And I came along, somebody I knew had been to Encounter before. And they said, let's go to one of the Christmas services, which we did. And I said to Mark then, I said, oh, I'll be joining you soon in Wychcombe. Of course, it's a much longer than I had ever thought it would. But when it was sort of confirmed that I was going to be moving to Wychcombe, a chap called Tim Watson, who was a retired vicar in Cheltenham, an incredible evangelist, I have to say. He was obviously having some meeting with Mark somewhere, I don't know where it was, but he said to look out for me coming along. And other people were encouraged to look out for me. I think Malcolm was asked to look out as well. And Chuck and our friend Alan was also told to look out for me. So when I actually moved, I can't remember exactly who it was that got me to church on the first Sunday. But basically, that's how it all started. And people like Alan and John guided me either there or back, depending what I wanted to do, until I felt sure of my route.
Peter, Ron here. I saw you getting a bit emotional when you spoke about your real meeting with Jesus. Could you tell us a bit more about that? I think all of us have that moment where we meet Jesus, and it's amazing.
I'll try, but it's as you noticed, very emotional. I had never thought. If you had said to me, as I said at my baptism, if you had said to me the year before, you will be baptized this time next year, you'll be in a church and you'll be baptized, I would have suggested that you went to Cheltenham General, because there was honestly, I just so and what amazed me and astounded me, I think, was that once the Lord had decided, he wouldn't let me turn back. He just wouldn't. And, even when there have been times since when I've been got a bit fed up with things. I'll stop going along. But if I don't come and meet other Christians in worship, I find I can't do it. I've just got to go back and carry on and pray my way through it. I call myself on occasions the reluctant Christian.
Thank you, Peter.
Peter, it's Mark here. Do you think that coming to Cheltenham might have had something to do with the race course and your love of horses?
Actually, what happened was, when I decided that I wanted to leave Bristol, I wrote down 10 places, Cheltenham being one of them. Yeah. And yes, of course, the race course had some bearing on it, because I'd been a visitor to the Cheltenham Festival for the last 25 years. So it did have a bearing on it. Actually, I haven't been to the festival since 2006, which is astonishing, but there is. I just can't go there anymore. So it did have a bearing, but of course there were these 10 places, and Cheltenham won out because it had so many advantages, not just that, but mainline connections. Because I thought I would be working.
Yeah.
Possibly in Birmingham or possibly in Bristol. That was the thing. I just wanted somewhere quieter to live. Bristol, I was, if I'm honest with you, I abused the nightlife. I loved the nightlife. I loved nightclubs. I used to know nightclubs in Bristol by the back of my own hand. I could tell people if they wanted to go to a decent pub, I could list out pubs that they might try, and I could tell them what the beer was like, and most importantly, what the loos were like.
Well, I see.
I just say one thing, though, one thing that really distresses me is that in my lifetime, getting employment for blind people has been really, really tough, and it doesn't get any easier. I noticed that when I was doing this, the RNIB, I looked on the RNIB, Royal National Institute for Blind People, on their site, and it said employment prospects among blind and partially sighted people have not changed in a generation. Only one in four people are in paid employment. Mm-hmm. You know, I find that disgraceful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, any last question before we close? Any burning question anybody's got?
I just wanted to ask you one thing, Peter, if nobody else has. I think I said to you, I've got to know you fairly recently, mainly through sitting next to you at the breakfast or the Christmas meal. And I admitted, you're the first person, blind person, I think I've spoken to or known. You've obviously conveyed that very eloquently that in some ways you don't, you want to be treated in the same way as everybody else is. But if there's one thing that you could request of us as a group, as a church, or individually, what would that be?
Well, there's nothing amazing to say on that score, because Ron has the Songs of Sunday in there. It's just a shame that my note taker is broken and I won't be able to replace it for a year, because all blind equipment costs an amazing amount of money. But that's no big deal. I can handle that, and I'll probably get around to brailing out the stuff. So I'm getting all the songs for Sundays, even if the music group suddenly throw me a curveball.
Yeah. See, they throw all of us a curveball, don't worry.
But not really. I mean, it just coming over and having a chat from sometime. I'm never going to, you're never going to catch my eye. So plastic, so unless I throw them at you.
But no, just coming over and having a chat. That's
all I ever ask of any church. Mm. One more question from Ron, and then. It's not a question. I just want to say something. You know, so in the week, I just sent a PDF of the songs that I'll play, and obviously the Lord can change them on the Sunday morning slightly, which is the curveball.
Yeah.
It's just really amazing, Peter, watching you stand there and singing in real time to the songs and engulfed in worship. And it's just, you know, it's amazing that you've overcome these things. But I don't think anyone here thinks of you in a different way as to different to any of us.
So, right.
I just wanted to say that.
Cool. Well, thank you again, Peter. That's been a really illuminating talk for us all, and very encouraging as well. So thank you for the time you put into it. Thank you for being so honest.
One of us.
A bit of information, as long as you promise not to make a lot of...
Well, let's say a huge thank you to Peter again, and actually tied to that, thank you to Jason. He doesn't need to know. All right.